In the spring of 1963, President John F. Kennedy grappled with two seismic forces of his time, the proliferation of nuclear arms around the globe and the struggle for civil rights at home. He took on those issues back to back, giving two powerful speeches on consecutive days. President Kennedy's speech on June 10, 1963, led to the first arms agreement of the Cold War. His speech on June 11th led to passage of the Civil Rights Act a year later. Andrew Cohen, a distinguished journalist based in Canada and a former Washington correspondent for the New York Times, joins us for this midday history lesson, JFK and 2 days in June, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour.
I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on Earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children, not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
As President John F. Kennedy, addressing graduates during the commencement ceremony at American University in Washington in 1963. That speech, given June 10th of that year, laid the groundwork for a nuclear arms treaty with the Soviet Union. Today, in this hour of midday, we're going back to June 1963, to a time of great anxiety, to the Cold War, and to the early stages of the civil rights movement. Our guest this hour is Andrew Cohen, an award-winning journalist based in Canada and a former Washington correspondent for the New York Times. In his book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History, Andrew Cohen chronicles the day President Kennedy made, the days Kennedy made back-to-back speeches about two of the most volatile issues of his time, nuclear arms and civil rights. The days were June 10th and 11th. And in the book, in rich detail, Andrew Cohen describes the tensions President Kennedy faced and how his speeches ultimately changed the course of history. Andrew Cohen is a professor of journalism and international affairs at Carleton University in Ottawa. He writes a nationally syndicated column and is a regular commentator on television and radio. Joining us again today to talk about his book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Andrew Cohen, it's a pleasure to get you on the Midday Show. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Dan.
You know, having grown up in that in the Kennedy years and, you know, look back at many times on his presidency, I remember these events. I knew about these events, the speeches, one on at American University and one to the nation, addressing the nation about civil rights, but I had no idea that they were on consecutive days. Did you know of those, that connection, before you started your research?
Well, I had been looking for a way in, having followed Kennedy for some time. I've written other books, but not on JFK. I'd been looking for a way into the Kennedy story. There is an erroneous figure that there are 40,000 books written about JFK. It's not true, but it's one of those urban and rural myths, I would suggest. But there are many books, and there are big biographies, and they are oral histories, and there are books on his relationship with his brother and virtually everybody else. I was looking for a way to tell JFK's story, to introduce him to a generation who do not know him. And when I looked at these 2 days, Dan, I thought, my goodness, these are two spectacular speeches. I mean, Kennedy gave many good speeches, but both were consequential. And on these 2 days, JFK pivots on these two most volatile issues, and he pivots in a way which is consequential, dramatic, and bold. And I use the word consequential because often presidential rhetoric is no more than rhetoric. But in this case, the first speech on June the 10th on nuclear arms leads to, as you've just said, the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. The speech the next night, written entirely in a different way and given in a different way, led to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So both speeches are important, not just because of what they said, but because of what they produced. And that's not, we can't always say that about presidential rhetoric.
We're going to set the stage for the first speech at American University by talking about the Cold War. Do you find, as a professor, you have to describe, you have to go at length to describe what the Cold War was about to your students?
Absolutely. And Dan, I don't know if you're of the age, but many of us will remember
duck and cover
in classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you did that, but we were told that the best way to protect ourselves from a nuclear attack was to crawl under our desks, and we practiced.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot understand that kind of thing. They don't understand what it was like to live in a world which lived in the shadow of the bomb. They don't know what nuclear shelters are. They don't remember the Cuban Missile Crisis and how terrifying that was to everybody alive, particularly John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, which is why they were talking in the spring of 1963 about trying to find a way to put the brakes on this. But there is, as there is in talking about the nature of race in America at that time, there is a great deal of puzzlement, I suppose, and incredulity that could things have been that way? And yes, they were that way. So what I try and do here is recreate that world.
And when we look at the American clock, you just referenced the Cuban Missile Crisis, which in my childhood, the scariest time in my childhood, that was October 62.
Right.
So coming out of that, I guess we need to talk about how that influenced and what got Kennedy to that speech at American U in June 63.
Well, in October 1962, the Russians and the Americans, the world, in a sense, the communist world, the free world, came as close to incinerating itself as before or since. This was the great crisis, the great confrontation, the great calamity of the Cold War, when the United States has to respond to missiles which Nikita Khrushchev, nuclear missiles which Nikita Khrushchev has placed in Cuba 90 miles from American shores. And it was a 13-day standoff. It's called the 13 Days. And at the end of it, so to remind listeners, the United States forces Nikita Khrushchev to withdraw those missiles. Both Kennedy and Khrushchev were shocked by how close they came. And interestingly enough, Dan, we know now that it was even closer than we knew at the time, because what we didn't know then was that Soviet battlefield commanders actually had control over those missiles. They could have launched them without approval from Moscow. So did missiles in the bellies of submarines, Soviet submarines. And we didn't know that till 20 years after, that in fact it was even closer than we thought. So if the Americans had bombed Cuba or had invaded Cuba, Soviet field commanders had permission to launch those missiles. And had they been launched, well, who knows what would have happened. The important thing is, though, by the spring of 1963, there have been erratic, fitful discussions between Moscow and Washington about the first way that both countries might try and lower the temperature, and that was to come to some kind of agreement on a test ban treaty. In those days, both the United States and the Soviet Union are testing nuclear warheads. John F. Kennedy has presided over the largest peacetime buildup, largest peacetime military buildup in American history. He's responding to Khrushchev, with whom he had a very difficult meeting in Vienna in May of 1961. It did not go well. Kennedy, emerging from that meeting, said it was the roughest thing in his life because Khrushchev was bullying and blustering and threatening to move on Berlin. So both countries are testing nuclear weaponry. They're filling the atmosphere with poisons. And there have been fitful back-channel discussions between Moscow and Washington about a test ban treaty, but nothing has happened. And in the spring of 63, Kennedy, who was using Pope John as a back channel, and Norman Cousins, the editor of the Saturday Review, they're trying to find a way to restart the discussion. And Kennedy says, why don't we give a speech on peace? Why don't we look at peace in a different way? Why don't I appeal to Americans to re-examine their views of the Russians, the Soviets, and appeal to Nikita Khrushchev to perhaps revisit how he thinks of us? And so that becomes the genesis of a speech, a commencement address at American University on June the 10th, 1963, in which John F. Kennedy will talk about these things. The speech, Dan, is written largely in secret. It is written by Ted Sorensen and a small group of Kennedy assistants, But it is not widely, within the United States government, there is no great consultation on this. The normal people who might be involved in the preparation of a presidential address on foreign affairs, such as the Department of State and the Department of Defense and the CIA, even Congress, are all cut out of this because JFK thinks, and his speechwriter Ted Sorensen thinks, that if they get a hold of what Kennedy is going to say, because he's going to talk about the Russians and to the Russians in a way no president had since the end of the Second World War, when the Russians and the Americans were allies, they're worried that they're going to sabotage the speech. So it's largely written in secret. And Kennedy is going to imagine a different kind of a world. He'll imagine a world not so much of winning the Cold War, but ending it.
We're going to listen to some excerpts from President Kennedy's speech at American University now. Let's go ahead. Now, this is a longer form of the clip that we opened the hour with. Let's listen to this first.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
And let's listen to a little bit more here. It's another clip, and then we'll get your comments on this, Andrew Cohen. A little bit more from President Kennedy's speech at American U.
As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war.
So he's making an appeal. This is, and we'll hear this again. We'll hear something similar in his address on civil rights, asking the American people, urging them to see the Russians, the Soviet Russians, as human beings.
Absolutely. And Kennedy, who has been, Dan, a cold warrior. No one can question his credentials in the 50s and the early part of his administration. Kennedy is looking at ways to look at the Russians differently and is asking Americans to recognize the Russians as human beings. I don't know if we'll play the clip, but later in the speech he'll say, we all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. We're all mortal. That we, Americans and Russians, live in this world and know we don't like their system, and we've heard for 18 years about its gulags and the Russian bear. But now we must also recognize that the Russians lost 20 million people in the Second World War, that they are pushing us in space. I mean, he recognized their scientific achievements because he has sent Americans into space and promised to land a man on the moon and return him to Earth by the end of the decade, which is exactly what happens. But he's saying to Americans, we have to deal with them. Let's look at a different ways of doing that. And he'll make an appeal then to Nikita Khrushchev. He'll say that we are going to declare a moratorium on the testing of nuclear weapons. We invite you to do the same, and let's begin negotiations. And as it happens, that's exactly what happens. Khrushchev invites American negotiators to Moscow. Within 6 weeks, there is comprehensive test ban treaty that the administration wanted, but a nuclear test ban treaty, which will ban the testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere.
So as one Andrew Cohen who has covered Washington and heard numerous speeches by presidents and others, you're looking for the news. So here we have, this is the clip that sort of lets on that there's real news here. This is President declaring that discussions have been planned between, the Soviet Union, and we must mention Great Britain also in this. But let's listen in on some more of the Kennedy speech.
I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev Prime Minister McMillan and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind.
There it is there. So there's your lead the next day. By the way, how was this story played in the press? I'm sure you went back to look at your alma mater, the New York Times, what their front page looked like.
Oh, no, it got big play. And I talked to people who were in the audience that day. There were 10,000 people at American University. Kennedy was giving a commencement address. It was terrifyingly hot. People are fainting all over the place, not Kennedy, who was out in that 96-degree heat for over an hour. But they clearly got it very early on. Now, was there a great popular reaction? No, there was not. There was a much greater one to the civil rights speech the next night. But over the years, and this is important, you know, some speeches acquire a certain resonance and a certain importance and a certain quality. And this speech, which was known as the American University speech, soon became known as the peace speech. And John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, said later in his life that if you really wanted to understand JFK and his thinking, if you really wanted to get to who the man was, don't read the inaugural address, which, however, interestingly written, and that's the Ask Not speech, which seems a little bit bellicose or belligerent today. He said, look at the peace speech, because that's where Kennedy feels that his future lay and the future of the United States, and trying to come to some kind of way of living with the Soviet Union.
We'll talk more about the peace speech of President Kennedy, as well as the speech he gave the next night on civil rights. This 2 days in June is the title of Andrew Cohen's book, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. I'll invite phone calls here from people who lived through this, who might have comments or questions about President Kennedy during those days in June. If you wish to share a memory or have a question for Andrew Cohen, this is how you reach us. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the Midday Show in Baltimore, 866-661-9309. And our email address, we welcome questions or comments by email, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest this hour, Andrew Cohen, one of the most distinguished journalists in Canada, award-winning journalist, former Washington correspondent with the New York Times, now teaching up in Canada at Ottawa at Carleton University. And he's an author, too. He's written about Pierre Trudeau, at least one book there. And this book, While Canada Slept, How We Lost Our Place in the World, you won an award for that, and I'd like to look that one up. I'm not familiar with that book, so I'll have to check it out. I like the title, how it sounds. what did you look? I'm just curious. What is that book about? How we lost?
Well, that's just that's a critique of Canadian foreign policy and how a country, a middle power that was once influential, particularly after the war, is no longer influential. It's a critique. Some people have called it a polemic, but I wouldn't go that far.
The book we're talking about today is 2 days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History, June 10th and 11th, 1963. One speech about peace, about attaining a nuclear test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. The next speech, the next night on television, about civil rights. We'll get to that in a moment. What was Khrushchev, what was Moscow's reception to this speech at American University first?
Well, that's very interesting because Kennedy, having flown across the country on Air Force One, and actually went on Air Force One myself to get a sense of what it was like in those days, and hit the tarmac at 8:50 a.m. on Monday, June the 10th, Kennedy races up to, he choppers to the White House, and then he races up to Northwest Washington, where American University is, and makes that speech. But it wasn't instant. The response from Moscow, which was 8 hours ahead of Washington, was not instantaneous. They would not know the content of that speech for several hours, and Kennedy's wondering, well, what does Khrushchev think? We know what he thinks by midnight of June the 10th, because he has done something that he has not done before and that, in fact, no Soviet leader had done in the Cold War. He orders the unjamming of Voice of America broadcasts. So up to that time, Dan, almost all Voice of America broadcasts in Russian had been jammed, and so Russians couldn't hear them. He orders the Russian translation of that speech heard in Russia, and he allows Izvestia and TASS, Izvestia, the state newspapers, TASS, the state news agency, to reprint the whole thing. He thinks this is pretty good. In fact, he'll tell Avril Harriman in Moscow a couple of weeks later that no president had spoken of Russians or to Russians that way since Franklin Roosevelt in 1945. And so the reaction is good. No one really knows what's going to happen in those talks, and negotiators will go to Moscow. Actually, they'll go very, very well, and the president will be intimately involved from Washington. And it will produce the first of the arms control agreements of the Cold War. It will be Kennedy's greatest foreign policy achievement.
Is this a hurry-up moment in John F. Kennedy's presidency? Sense of urgency, sense of I must act now? He wasn't worried about being a one-term president, was he?
Kennedy read history, he wrote history, and he wanted to make history. Kennedy knew what the elements of greatness were. He, among the people on his staff, was Arthur Schlesinger, the great presidential historian who twice won the Pulitzer Prize. He won it for his interpretation of Andrew Jackson and then would later win it for his interpretation of John F. Kennedy after JFK's death. But Kennedy often talked about presidents and what the elements of greatness are. And Kennedy had had an uneven presidency, I think it's safe to say. And he's 2.5 years into his presidency in the spring of 1963. That presidency would end, Dan, as you know, 5.5 months later in Dallas. So, yes, there was a sense of urgency. I call these 2 days, which I follow hour by hour, so you get a sense of what the president was doing at every turn. I call it JFK's lyrical journey to peace and freedom. It's where I think he becomes president. I think it's his crowded hour in which he pivots. And these two issues, it's almost accidental that the speeches happen on two consecutive days because one is planned and one is not. One is nearly spontaneous. And I imagine we'll talk about that one shortly, the civil rights speech. But he is using opportunities that come to him. In the case of civil rights, it's a crisis, and he does not want to let a crisis go to waste, so he will turn on that. The other speech had been in the works, however secret, for several weeks, the civil rights speech, in a matter of hours.
Let's take a call for our guest, Andrew Cohen, before we go on to talk about President Kennedy's speech on civil rights, June 11th, 1963. Calvin in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, good day, gentlemen. Thank you. Mr. Cohen, thank you very much for appearing today. I apologize for my nervousness right off the bat, and I hope I don't ramble here, but I read a lot about President Kennedy as a young airman, enlisted guy in the U.S. Air Force stationed in Germany, Lindley Air Station in Wiesbaden, about his writing himself. It's written that he wrote his own inaugural speech on a plane on the way to his inauguration. What I'd like to know is that I haven't heard the civil rights speech yet. I did listen to the previous, the other speech on Moscow, the Soviet Union. How much of this, it was written by Mr. Sorensen, as you said, but how much of this was actually President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy himself, from his heart? Thank you, sir.
Well, Calvin, a lot of it was John F. Kennedy. By the 1960s, the modern presidency relied on speechwriters. This wasn't Lincoln at Gettysburg or Lincoln who wrote all his speeches. The presidency required speechwriters. Ted Sorensen had been with JFK for 11 years in 1963. Ted Sorensen, who was his enormously gifted and versatile speechwriter, who was absolutely dedicated to John F. Kennedy, who, as I say, joined him when JFK was a senator in 1953 and was with him in Washington in 1963. Theirs was perhaps the most productive relationship between a speechwriter and a president. They could finish each other's sentences, and Sorensen was described as the assistant president, as the president's intellectual blood bank. How much did JFK write of his own speeches? Well, he didn't draft them, but in the case of the peace speech, he worked on it. He didn't see it till he's returning from Hawaii on June the 9th. He has flown Sorensen out to Honolulu to return with him on Air Force One with Avril Harriman, Kennedy's diplomatic troubleshooter, and Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader. He wants to run the draft by those two, and he wants to then work on the phrases with Sorensen. So Kennedy does that, but does Kennedy draft the speech himself? No. Very few presidents would draft anything, but he is intimately involved with the sound of the speech, with the tone of the speech, and I know this because we see his editing. But Sorensen was so good that Kennedy didn't have to do a lot. He would have known what Kennedy would have liked. He would have known the words and the phrases which Kennedy would have embraced. So theirs was a highly successful, productive partnership.
And Sorensen was a pretty good deadline writer, too, wasn't he, Andrew Cohen? He finished the speech we're going to talk about here, based on your book, looks like about 4 minutes before the president went on national television.
Well, can we back up a sec?
Oh, we're going to.
Just to set some context, he does. When Kennedy returns from American University on June the 10th, he's got a big crisis in Alabama where George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, the segregationist governor of Alabama, is promised to stand in the door of the University of Alabama and prevent the admission of two, as they're then called, Negro students who want to enroll at the University of Alabama. And the Kennedys have been exasperated by George Wallace. He's a little man with a big complaint. He's not taking their phone calls. He's not listening to them. He wants his show, and they have to give it to them. And they're worried there's going to be violence if he refuses the admission of these two students. As it happens, the Kennedys will send their representatives to the door to enforce the court order integrating the university. That will happen at about 11 a.m. on June the 11th in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where the governor has flown. The governor will refuse the admission of Vivian Malone and James Hood, the two Negro students who have been carefully chosen by the NAACP to make this a stand. The Kennedys will do what they have to do. They'll federalize the National Guard in Alabama, send it up to Tuscaloosa, and at 3:30, roughly 3:40, they will force Governor Wallace to stand aside, and they will integrate that university. It is at that point, 3:40 in Tuscaloosa, but 5:40 in Washington. There was then a two-hour time difference between Washington and Alabama that time of year in that year, that JFK will turn to Ted Sorensen, who, as you pointed out, Dan, can do just about anything, and say, Ted, it's time now to give that speech on civil rights. And Ted Sorensen says to him, what speech? There is no speech. And Kennedy says, and by the way, I've booked the networks for 8 p.m. this evening for 15 minutes, so you'll handle it, Ted. And JFK goes swimming, which he did twice a day in the White House pool. Well, there begins Ted Sorensen's feverish afternoon or moment of trying to pull together a speech that JFK will give in that it's a short speech, but that would be very, very important because Kennedy is going to do the same thing in that speech, in a sense, he's done the day before. He's going to appeal to Americans, as you said earlier, Dan, to see Negro Americans differently, to see them as human beings. He will say in that speech, this is no longer, that is civil rights, a legal question. It is a moral question. And morality is infused in this speech. He'll talk about what it's like to be a black American in America in 1963. And, you know, he'll say that, frankly, the patrician JFK, who doesn't know any black people, he'll say, you know, a Negro born in America has half as much chance of finishing high school, one-third as much chance of completing college, one-third as much chance of becoming a professional, twice as much chance of becoming unemployed, a life expectancy of 7 years shorter. So he'll describe the plight of black Americans, and he'll say to white Americans, in what is an apartheid white supremacist America in the South, he'll say, would you be content to be black today? And in that speech, he'll promise to send to Congress the next day what will be the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But in the writing of that speech, Sorensen has only 2 hours, and he is running around the White House. And as it happens, then, JFK does not go on the air with a complete speech. By 3 minutes to eight, JFK, having done something he's never done before, he walks down to Sorensen's office, which is only down the hall, but the president didn't go to the offices of his assistants, and says to Ted at about 7:15, "How's that speech coming along?" And Sorensen says, "Well, not bad. It's coming out of my typewriter." And Kennedy says, "Well, I'm relieved to hear it. I thought I would have to go on the air without a speech." Well, as it happens, he does go on the air without a complete speech. The speech is 14 minutes. And when Kennedy hits the 11-minute mark, he runs out of text. So he just keeps talking. He wings it. He extemporizes it. And he continues to talk, in Sorensen's words largely, about what it's like, or what he thinks it's like, to be a black American in America in 1963. Dan, it's a head-spinning, knockdown performance.
We're going to hear some excerpts from that. We're also going to listen to a clip of George Corley Wallace down in Tuscaloosa. So I want to go back to that event of that day, and you used the word pivot with Kennedy. So how much did the events of that particular day down at the University of Alabama, with George Wallace standing there in the doorway, push Kennedy into this speech?
Well, Kennedy had been called by critics a laggard on civil rights. In the black community, Dr. King, when Kennedy picked up his New York Times on Monday, June the 10th, 1963, after he had arrived back from Hawaii, and Kennedy read about seven newspapers a day because he was a speed reader, which, by the way, he learned in Baltimore, he would see an interview with Reverend King in which Dr. King says, "You know, JFK, you've only exchanged a miserable policy of the Eisenhower administration for an inadequate one." He would have seen a full-page ad from the American Jewish Congress saying, "Kennedy, your civil rights policy is a folly and a failure." The Kennedys didn't think that way. They would have said, "You know, we've hired more black Americans than any other administration. We've integrated more schools and public institutions." But it wasn't enough. Neither King nor the American Jewish Congress knows what's going on in the White House that day, nor do they know what Kennedy has been thinking for the last month. He has been appalled by the riots, and riots are almost as common as grits in the American South in 1963, but he's particularly appalled, sickened really, by the high-pressure hoses and the snarling dogs which have been set upon the protesters in the day-after-day in Birmingham, Alabama, in May of 1963, just 2 weeks before. It's at that point the Kennedys, and I say Robert Kennedy because he's intimately involved in these 2 days, they say that it is time to introduce that Civil Rights Act. The Kennedys were worried about it. They thought that it would so alienate the Southern legislators that it would take down their whole legislative program. They worried about what it would do to the Democratic Party in the South. And they were right to worry about that, because the Democratic Party would pay a big price for its embrace of civil rights. And they worried about what it would do to JFK's reelection in 1964, which was no sure thing in 1963. So Kennedy, though, having said all that, Dan, there are no focus groups, there are no polls. Kennedy decides, this is what it means to be president. This is what I have to do as president. He says to someone, "If I'm going to go down, I will go down on a point of principle." And against the advice of every advisor but Bobby Kennedy, his brother, and there are many, Kennedy will decide to give the speech that night. It will be somewhat impulsive, but it will be a gifted, impressive, memorable performance, which will then propel Kennedy and his administration for the next 5.5 months to embrace civil rights, to work with Dr. King, and to send that bill to Congress, and to hope to get that through, which, of course, will not happen before he's killed in November of 1963.
To set up the president's speech to the nation on civil rights, let's listen to something from the showdown, a recording from the showdown between George Wallace, the governor of Alabama on that day, who's defying this order and blocking the doorway at the University of Alabama. The Kennedy administration has sent the Deputy U.S. Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach down there. And here's George Wallace. Here's what he has to say on that day.
"Now, therefore, I, George C. Wallace, as governor of the state of Alabama, do hereby denounce and forbid this illegal and unwarranted action by the central government."
"Governor Wallace, I take it from that statement that you are going to stand in that door, and that you are not going to carry out the orders of this court, that you are going to resist us from doing so. Is that correct?"
"I stand upon the statement."
He stands upon this statement, but how did that showdown play out, Andrew?
Well, not very well for Mr. Wallace at first. George Wallace will stand in the door and will prevent the integration of the university at that hour. But the two students and the Kennedys are very concerned about the dignity of these two students. They are two young black Americans from Alabama who want an education. They're carefully prepared for this by the Justice Department. They dress very, very carefully as if they're going to church. Vivian Malone particularly wears a strand of pearls. They are not the face of protest that we will imagine, Dan, later in the 1960s. They don't want to overthrow the system. They just want to join it. Mm-hmm. And so it won't work out very well for them initially. But after the confrontation in the door, they will be actually taken to their dormitories and they will be registered in the university. But George Wallace will return that afternoon. And the Kennedys, having federalized the National Guard, they don't have to carry him off, which was their fear. They don't have to make a martyr of him, which was their fear. They don't have to arrest him for contempt of court. He will walk away. It will give him a sense of celebrity in the South. He will run four times for the presidency after that. He will not win, of course, but he will be a spoiler. And so in his defeat is kind of a victory for him, but the university will be integrated. And the Kennedys, seeing the integration of the university, saying, this is a crisis which we are not going to let to go to waste, which is why the president, pivoting that night, says, I'm going to go on the air and talk about the morality of civil rights. I'm going to introduce the Civil Rights Act. And more than anything, I am going to turn the presidency into the bully pulpit that Theodore Roosevelt always said it should be, the moral power of the office to embrace civil rights and to persuade Americans that this is the right thing to do. And it was the right thing to do, and Kennedy begins that process.
We'll hear some of the Kennedy's President Kennedy's speech to the nation that night on civil rights, a mere, by my calculation, 2.5 hours after this confrontation ended in Tuscaloosa. Andrew Cohen is our guest. We're talking about his book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. You're listening to Midday on WYPR. If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join us by calling 410-662-8780 or send me an email with a question or comment, midday@wypr.org.
The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated.
President Kennedy speaking to the nation at 8 p.m. Washington time on June 11th, 1963. Andrew Cohen is our guest. He's written a book about these 2 days in June. In fact, that's the title of his book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. How much or how little had the president spoke about civil rights and equality and the problems in the South prior to that?
Not a lot. Not a lot. You know, Jack Kennedy was a patrician from Boston, from Jack Kennedy of Brookline and Bronxville and Georgetown and an all-white Navy and an all-white Congress, Irish, Catholic, who didn't come from a former slave state and didn't speak its language. One of the distinguishing things about JFK as well, Dwight Eisenhower and Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson were known to use the word nigger. JFK never did. He had been so seared by religious intolerance in his campaign as the first Catholic to be elected president in 1960. He didn't use that language, but that didn't make him someone who knew much about black America. And he had to learn. He knew his valet and he knew those he had appointed to his administration who were black, but he didn't know them. And he had been under, as I was saying earlier, some pressure to speak earlier. The Kennedys had integrated the University of Mississippi in 1962. That was just 3 weeks before the Cuban Missile Crisis. It had touched off a 15-hour riot in which two people were killed and many were injured. But as I say, some considered him, his critics had said he was too slow on civil rights. Others will argue, I would argue, that in fact, had they sent up this bill, the Civil Rights Act in 1962, it would have gone nowhere because public opinion wasn't there. It actually took Birmingham and the repeated Negro protests in American cities to push along this this very heavy stone sled. And by June of 63, he does that.
Here's another excerpt from the president's address to the nation that night.
Therefore, I'm asking for your help in making it easier for us to move ahead and to provide the kind of equality of treatment which we would want ourselves, to give a chance for every child to be educated to the limit of his talents. As I've said before, not every child has an equal talent or an equal ability or equal motivation, but they should have the equal right to develop their talent and their ability and their motivation to make something of themselves.
We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and as a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increased demonstrations in the street. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all, in all of our daily lives. Again, another quote there from President Kennedy's speech. You note in the book, Andrew, that Martin Luther King Jr. leapt to his feet and cried to his friend, Walter Fauntroy, Walter, can you believe that white man not only stepped up to the plate, he hit it over the fence, and he dashed off a wire to JFK saying, quote, it was one of the most eloquent, profound, and unequivocal pleas for justice and freedom of all men ever made by any president. You spoke passionately for moral issues involved in the integration struggle, end quote from MLK. Well, yeah, I can understand why Martin Luther King Jr. would be pleased to hear the president give that 14-minute address. How did it go over in the country? What was the news coverage like the next day?
Well, Dr. King couldn't believe what he was hearing because he had been a critic of the president. Now he'd become an ally.
Mm-hmm.
The coverage was very favorable, particularly in the North. It hurt Kennedy in the South. His popularity would drop there sharply, and he worried about that. The usual critics in Congress, the segregationist white senators, of course, criticized it. They said there's no need for the law to integrate lunch counters or movie theaters or shops. They felt that this was Barry Goldwater, who would run for the Republicans the next year, was one of those who said that this was all unnecessary and he would vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. By and large, it was positive, but there was no assurance, Dan, that JFK would be reelected. And they hoped they would face Goldwater, but if it were Rockefeller, they worried about that. And this was politically a very difficult decision. One of the things I was able to do here, Dan, in recreating the TikTok of the American presidency and following JFK through these 48 hours, in which he does many other things which are unrelated to nuclear symmetry or civil rights, is I saw documentary film footage, outtakes in Hollywood, which have not been seen before. And I was able, this was footage shot in the White House over these 2 days, particularly around the civil rights material or the civil rights conversation, in which I see and did see Bobby and Jack Kennedy talking about the implications of this. And I use that, I hope, to give the book a sense of atmosphere and to put the reader there, because when you see grainy black and white film of the brothers and the advisors, both in the Department of Justice and in the Oval Office, you get a strong sense of how this was consuming both of them. They realized the importance of this, and that's why that speech, hurried as it was, that it came off the right way, was so important to Kennedy's fortunes.
And you really capture beautifully the ticking clock on the confrontation with Wallace and the way Bobby Kennedy was all over that and on the phone with his brother. Listen, I have an email here that relates to the earlier part of our conversation and the speech the day before on June 10th. Bob in Pikesville saying that while I applaud JFK's courage and resolve in pursuing the nuclear disarmament, let's not forget his role in escalating the Vietnam War. Cold warriors die hard. What's your comment on that, Andrew?
Well, that assumes that, of course, there were 17,000 advisors. And by the way, Dan, Vietnam, something happens in Vietnam. A shocking thing happens in Vietnam in the morning of June the 11th, which Kennedy becomes aware of, which will change American policy on President Diem, who was then the president of Vietnam. There's no doubt Kennedy did send more advisors to Vietnam, but it was a low-level conflict. The question I'm often asked, and no doubt you've discussed and thought about before on your show, is that what would have happened had JFK lived? Mm-hmm. Would Vietnam have happened? And if there's one thing that I take from the time I spent with JFK over these 2 days in trying to look into how he thinks is that he felt quite confident that he could ignore his advisors. And when his advisors told him not to make the speech on civil rights, he made it anyway. It was those advisors who would advise Lyndon Johnson, many of them, people like Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara and McGeorge Bundy, who did support Lyndon Johnson in the escalation of that war. The difference between Lyndon Johnson and JFK was Lyndon Johnson lacked confidence in foreign affairs, and JFK didn't. And I think JFK would have said no, and he would not have committed America to a land war into China.
And that a photograph of a burning monk in Saigon, this is something that Kennedy recoiled from, like I guess most people did. What else could you say about his reaction to that?
Well, he's on the phone with Bobby at about 8 a.m. on June the 11th. That's the day the confrontation will take place with George Wallace in just about 3 hours. And so they're strategizing about a handle Wallace. And Kennedy, who had a number of newspapers on his lap and would, as I said earlier, would read papers, as James Resson said, would have printer's ink for breakfast because at breakfast he would go through many, many papers. And he was a speed reader who could, his eyes would just go down and absorb the hard, cold type. But he sees this picture, which is horrific, of a Buddhist monk who has set himself on fire the day before in protest over the policy of the Vietnamese government toward Buddhists in Vietnam. And Buddhists were a majority, and the government was largely Zem's government was Catholic. And that repels Kennedy, who says, I cannot have a religious war in Vietnam. I can't be trying to handle this, dealing with religious freedom in Vietnam when I'm trying to promote racial freedom at home. And that leads to a reappraisal of American support for President Diem, who will be overthrown in a coup the United States knows a great deal about, if it did not encourage. In November of 1963, it will be the first of the two assassinations in 1963, 3 weeks before JFK's.
I didn't, until this moment, realize Diem's assassination was so close to Kennedy's.
3 weeks.
Andrew, we're short of time now, but we have a quick question we can get to from Paul, who called from Oakland. Paul, can you do it briefly, please?
Yeah, very quickly, Dan. Mr. Cohen, you said that Dr. King was caught by surprise by Kennedy's speech on civil rights, and yet only 10 weeks later, Dr. King led this historic march on Washington. And I'm just wondering if there's anything you think might have perhaps gone behind the scenes that brought these two, you know, wary allies in civil rights closer together when Kennedy made that speech that had any impact on what King did 10 weeks later in Washington.
Interesting.
Well, it did have an impact, and the speech that John F. Kennedy gave surprised Dr. King, and Dan has just mentioned the surprise that with which Dr. King greeted that speech, and he didn't think Kennedy, you know, white Jack Kennedy from, you know, Brahmin Boston could make that type of speech, and yet JFK did. The March on Washington at which Dr. King spoke was to be, at first, a march against the administration.
That's right.
After King hears the speech, the march becomes not against the administration, or not directed at the administration, but directed to Congress in the hope that it would encourage Congress to pass that civil rights bill. So from June on, Dr. King and President Kennedy are allies. And Kennedy doesn't go to the speech on August 28th, but he wishes he were there. And he said, he greets King after, and he says, that was a very fine speech. That was the I Have a Dream speech. And by then, Kennedy and King are allies in this great moral cause, which is civil rights.
Andrew Cohen, I certainly have enjoyed this hour with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
A great pleasure, Dan.
Yeah. I'll tell folks again that the book we've been discussing by Andrew Cohen is 2 days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Thank you again so much. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed our program, and we'll come back again soon. We'll see you in about 22 hours for another edition of our show.